Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, named after the fictional small town found in several of author Michael DeCamp's books. This podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll hear interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, performers, and entrepreneurs, sprinkled with friendly banter about any number of topics, all of which attempt to view the world through the lens of creativity. Turn up the volume and enjoy the latest conversations in Cutter's Notch.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm your host, Michael DeCamp, and I am here with my usual co-host.
Hello, it's Nancy DeCamp. Good to see you, Mike.
Good to see you. I haven't seen you in like 30 seconds.
Right.
And also with us today is one of my author friends from the local author community in Indianapolis, Matthew Barron. Hello, Matthew.
Hello. How are y'all doing?
Good. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
And we're looking forward to kind of talking about what Matthew writes, you know, what his books are all about, his processes, his inspirations. Maybe, you know, what his social security number is, yeah. Credit card numbers, things like that.
Mother's maiden name.
Yeah.
What was the name of the street,
you grew up on?
Yeah, let's just give away all that personal information. So, at any rate.
You know what we got to start out with, Mike?
Oh, that would be our creative indulgences, yes. Nancy. So what's your creative indulgence?
I knew you would come to me first. So I'll share two quick ones. One is kind of a regular. When we're at home and don't have a lot of things to do Saturday mornings, we like to watch the CBS Saturday morning show. And the thing that I enjoy, you get a little news, but you get human interest stories, but then they always go to some restaurant. So you see different cuisine, that's a creative area that I'm always interested in. And then they always have a musical artist. And I have from that show attained a liking or the ability to download perhaps a new album that's out of an old artist. And so I find that to be a creative indulgence where I learn and do things. And then the other quick little thing I started just this morning, I love IndyCar and race cars. And my youngest daughter for Christmas gave me a little wooden race car, like craft kit that you can paint the little race car. So I started painting my race car today. That's my creative indulgence.
That's cool.
Very good.
Really cool.
Well, I will tell you mine, and then Matthew will let you go third. That way you get a chance to think about it even a little bit more. Later on when we get to the random question, you go first. So, you know, turnabout's fair play. But I got I got several books for Christmas.
It's always a good Christmas gift. It's always birthday gift, Christmas gift. Give me a book, we're good.
Speaking for both me and Matthew, books make great gifts.
Yes, they do.
They do indeed.
And you should explore a wide variety of them.
So, especially if they're written by either somebody named DeCamp or somebody named Barron.
Yes.
So, those are very good last names for authors.
I think so.
Perfect. They're perfect names. So I got this, Nancy, I think you gave these
to
me.
I did.
Yeah, she gave me three books in this series. It's written by Susan Cooper. These were written in like the 1960s, actually.
Were they written in?
Yeah, quite a while ago. But it's kind of a middle grade children's kind of book, but sometimes those are fun to read. This series, The Dark is Rising Sequence, it's kind of Arthurian, like King Arthur.
Cool.
I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly, but
Arthurian?
Arthurian?
Did I say it right?
Yeah. So it's modern day 1960s. So it's, in the first book, Oversea Under Stone, follows three children who were on holiday to a little town on the coast of England, I think in the Cornwall area, called Trewisic. Not sure I said that right. But they go on a quest with their great uncle, Mary, when you do the whole thing together, sounds a lot like Merlin. So Merriman Lion. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you run that together really quick,
that's fun.
Sounds a little bit like Merlin. So, at any rate, they go on a quest. I read the first one, last week, and I started the second one, which is The Dark is Rising. That's the name of the second
one. And that one's received an award, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's got right on the top, the Newbery Honor book. And it's a great little story so far.
I've seen a lot.
Only just a smidge into it.
Just a smidge in. And I will say, backstory context, I got that book for you because I saw that book everywhere where I go and look at, you know, new book options and such. And a lot of people said that second book that they tend to reread it every December, like or with the winter solstice or something like that. So I'm like, well, that's kind of interesting. But I thought, well, I don't, maybe that is the book out of all the series. But I thought, well, let's start out with 1, 2, 3 and we'll see, you know.
Obviously, I'm not very far into the book yet, but I can tell you that it's set in December.
Well, there you go.
And there's a big pending, it's like a big snowstorm. So,
all right.
I can see why maybe they might read it every December.
I like reading the younger books every once in a while. Just
definitely.
Yeah. So that's
even though it's an older book, the packaging looks very modern on it.
Yeah. They've probably updated it. I'm guessing.
Oh yeah.
So this one was written in the 1960s. I haven't actually checked to see when
the one you're reading now, you pointed at it. You didn't say which you said this one.
Yeah. This one, the second book, which is The Dark is Rising. It has a publication date of introduction copyright 2013. So she had a fairly long window in between books.
Yeah. Well, that says introduction copyright. That could be different than the content.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The content text said it was 2011. Because there's
a lot in the series.
Oh, so it's still quite a gap.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, though, the series, there's like 12 or 14 books. I mean, granted, they're more kid books, so they're not huge, but
yeah, she created a definite catalog of additional works in between her first book in the sequence and the second. At least I think the first one was 1960. So I went and looked at it the other day, but I'm in my 60s now, so I might forget some things. So Matthew, what about you? What do you have for a creative indulgence?
I just finished a really big project in like October-ish. And so I've been really kind of burned out on a lot of things lately. So I've been concentrating a lot on trying to like reintroduce myself to my friends who forgot I existed over that time. And
it's like a big project.
It is a big project. And then try to worry about my physical health a little bit as well, because all that time of sitting in one place for several months doing very repetitive tasks was not really great for my health.
Sure.
So I've been a little burned out on a lot of things lately, but I did read recently. I finished reading a couple of the old Shadow stories from the 1930s.
Oh, okay.
So, the Shadow knows.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. So yeah, it was when he first meets Shiwan Khan, which is one of his arch nemeses. Although he didn't meet him until quite a bit into his publishing history. So
I didn't know that those were books. I just knew that they were radio. It was a radio show. So those came from books.
I could go on and on about the Shadows history. So to be careful.
That might be another podcast to discuss some of those things, because we want to focus on you and your work today.
Because he was an accidental character. Like, he was never meant to be a main character. It's really very interesting. Yeah, the history. I'll shut up now because I'm about to go.
Holding back, Mike.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny how that works, because I can tell you that in my own books, there's a character that's introduced in the first book and really is a secondary character, but he's now appeared in all four of my novels. He's the only character who appears in all four of the novels. And in the last one, he was more of a
more
primary
prominent
character.
Yeah, more prominent.
It's like, okay, yeah, it's like, well, I didn't intend it him when I first introduced him to be much more than a secondary character, but he's become this recurring person. So, and I've got a second character that I just kind of threw into the second book, and now he's become even more primary in the fourth book. And they're not all in the same series. This new book is in a new series.
That's really cool, because then it gives it a consistency for the reader, something familiar.
Yeah.
It also gives some of those secondary characters they need. It's sort of like they just come in and then they leave again. And it's so nice when you can recycle or reuse some of them. And it just gives them more fullness.
Yeah.
Right.
As a supporting character too.
You kind of flesh them out a little bit more.
Yeah. And then at the end, and then apparently then now he's becoming more of a main character. So you've had like this build up, which is really cool too.
Yeah.
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 Well, let's talk about your books.
Yeah. My books.
You're quite the prolific.
You got
writer.
He's in front of me between Matthew and I. He's got a stack of books that he's brought for us that he can talk about. Tell us about your range. Tell us the range of books that you have, maybe some highlights of the stories, things like that. And let's give you the mic for a while. Sure. You can just share about them.
Well, I've been writing for quite a while. So like people will look at my website or what I've got on my table and they'll be like, wow, you do so much. And I do need to remind people, this has taken me a really long time to build up this catalog. It hasn't happened overnight. I remember being the guy in the bookstore, in the front of the bookstore with one book, trying to get people to buy that one book and giving them the sad puppy dog author eyes.
Yeah.
Feeling very lonely.
Yes. Please buy my book. I always say there, don't make eye contact with the lonely author because,
right? They're going
to
be like,
hello, would you like to talk about my book? I've got quite a range. I've done some stuff for younger, like I've got a kid's book out there, but within like a month or so of the kid's book, I also had a short story published in an anthology of robot erotica.
Okay.
So,
I'm not sure how that works. Maybe you should not explain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're adult, you understand. If you're younger, you don't need to yet.
Yeah. I think my story had a bit of an advantage because there was a plot. Let's put it that way. Submission editors were like, oh, I'm exaggerating. Some of those stories are actually really good. But there are a couple that are like, a robot, what should we do with it?
So, right.
Yeah. But with the kid. And so they have
your kid's story.
Yeah. The kid's
short story.
Yeah. And then, let's see. So then I've got a lot of short stories, my most recent book is a short story collection, which spans like 30 years because the earliest story was published in a student literary magazine in 1994.
Wow.
And the most recent was in an anthology in May of 2024. So it is literally 30 years
of work
work in this book. So I'm really proud of it. And it's there's a lot of variety in there, but a lot of them do have a horror, definite horror vibe or a Twilight Zone kind of vibe. We're entering a dimension of sight. Yeah. Not of sight or sound, but of mind. We have a lot. So that's my latest work. I also have some sword sorcery, paranormal mysteries, a couple of thin novellas, paranormal mystery, a dystopian that came out in 2008. That's one of my earliest books. And then I have three graphic novels as well that I worked with artists on. And I produced two plays as well for the Fringe Festival, which is way outside of my comfort zone because I am, like most writers, I'm a very introverted, socially awkward guy who got into this because he likes to sit alone in his basement creating worlds, not because he likes to go out and say, hey, look at me.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
So you kind of piqued my interest when you said that you had a graphic novel.
Yeah.
So you used some artists. How did all that work?
Before you answer how it worked, could I ask a preceding question?
No.
I'm going to do it anyways. It's like, can I ask a question? You just did, right? So I guess explain maybe for those out there who don't know, what's the difference between a graphic novel and a novel?
Oh, yeah. Good question. Yeah. So a graphic novel is basically a long comic book. I'm not sure when the term was actually coined. Yeah. I know, what is that? I'm trying to think. Was it Will Eisner? Wrote the first thing that was considered a graphic novel, I think, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
So it's basically a long comic book. And a lot of the ones you'll see now are a collection of where they've taken several comics and combined them into one volume.
Yeah.
And The Walking Dead was a graphic novel or started out. As,
oh, really?
Yeah. There were multiple iterations of it. Sure. That's how it turned into such a big TV
Yeah. Walking Dead started out as a comic book and then they collected them into
a graphic novel
into trades or graphic novels. Mm-hmm. Originally they were more standalone. They weren't just collected. They were like a standalone book. And you still see quite a bit of those too. They're just standalones. We wrote this as a graphic novel. It was never in single issue form.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you interrupting Mike's question.
But if you're familiar with a comic book, you basically know the format of a graphic novel. It's just longer.
Yeah. So, and there's artwork involved.
Yes. Just like a comic.
So what's the process like in writing a graphic novel versus writing a regular novel?
Very different. Very different. And there's no like one way to do it right too. Like there's a lot of variation on how it's done. I'm a bit of a control freak. So I write and I had sketches of how the characters are supposed to look. I had page breakdowns, like what we call full script format.
Yep.
So you do like, so page one, three panels, panel one, this happens, panel two, you know, row two, panel two, this happens. So it's very, you know, very kind of specific. Like I knew exactly how many pages when I was
plotted it all the way out. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I'm pitching it to an artist, I say, can you do this many pages, which is kind of helpful because that gives the artist an idea of, okay, how much work is this going to be for
me? Right.
You know, because it's a you lot
don't
of work.
Know.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like similar to when I ask for proofreading help and they might be like, well, let me see a page or two of your work first, because that way I can gauge how long it's going to take. If you're full of proofreading errors, it might take me a lot longer.
Or it's very technical in nature, so I have to slow down in how I read.
Right.
And such.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I'm just completely curious here. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the thought of creating a graphic novel or comic kind of book maybe passed through my brain at one time, but I have never explored it. Mm-hmm. What does it cost to hire an artist to create a graphic novel?
I imagine that would depend, right?
It depends a lot.
Just a range.
And that's, unfortunately, I'm not going to answer that because the range is so wide. And then also because like the artists I work with, they might've cut me a deal for one reason or another.
And this would kind of throw them off.
Exactly. If other writers are like, well, you charged Matt this.
Let's just say, is it in the hundreds or the thousands?
It's a lot. Let's just put it that way. Okay.
I would imagine that would be tied to also the complexity and the length of the book.
Yeah.
Would play into that. The skill required.
The artist, the particular artist too. Yeah. Like if you're
more renowned, more profitable artist, it's going to cost you more.
If you're trying to get Todd McFarlane or Jim Lee to draw your book, you're going to be in many.
Versus somebody who's maybe getting their master's or something like that.
A student or somebody like that who's just getting in, you might be able to get a little bit of a better deal. But it's a lot of work and a lot of people who've not done it before do not realize how much work
I'm sure.
It is.
Yeah. It's not like sitting and planning or just even going the flow on a story.
Exactly. Well, storytelling as well as just the art, the ability to tell a story with art.
And I would imagine it's a little bit more difficult, but I would think doing the, as a playwright, that requires a little bit more effort. Is that true?
I would maybe a little less maybe in some ways, because the other people are going to fill a lot of the stuff out for you. When you're writing a novel, like if you walk into a room, you know, everything, if the reader needs to know what's in the room, you got to tell them it's in the room.
I see.
And for a play, the character walks in a room. If there's something that the reader or the audience needs to see in that room,
it's going
to
be there.
But
that
as
makes
a playwright,
sense.
You still got to write that down.
You have to describe what's in the room, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking on a graphic novel, you have to describe for the artist what you want the picture to look like to tell the story, because you're not telling it with words. You're telling it with images.
Yeah. And that's part of where there's so much, no standard basically in a lot of ways, because I write full script format. I provide reference photos and things. Like I had some different locations. I went on Google and found photos of the locations and said, you know, establishing shot, here's the location. I had sketches of the characters, sketches of the items. I initially tried to do thumbnails, but my thumbnails are like stick figures. So most of the artists didn't use them, but one artist did. Actually, we had some language barrier issues. So he actually did end up using some of those thumbnails of the page layouts and things. But yeah, so me, I'm a little bit of a control freak in that way, but there's also the opposite extreme where the writer will outline it. And then
they have to come up with,
the artist is basically a co-writer at that point, because yeah, they're the ones doing the page breakdowns, figuring out sometimes figuring out what things look like. And then even when I draw it out, when I sketch it out for them, still it's going to get then refiltered through that other artist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's a bit scary giving that level of control to somebody else.
Right.
And then when you get the art back, inevitably, it's not going to be exactly what you imagined. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible. Like, if you want it to be exactly the same, you better learn to draw.
Yeah.
So then you got to think, okay, you get the art back. Okay, pick your battles. It's not going to match exactly what you had in your head. What's right. important?
What's most important for
like,
you?
Yeah. Like, this character's nose doesn't look the way you want it to. Well, is that a plot point? If it's a plot point, maybe that's important. But otherwise, you better just get used to...
It sounds very similar to how I understand or have seen people write songs between the lyrics and the music, you know, very collaborative back and forth. No, I didn't quite. I needed something a little softer in that area at least it sounds.
Yeah.
The process sounds that way.
And with songs, too, there's also this level of, again, there's no standard in that relationship between the both sides of that coin. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they work very collaboratively, and it's very each person has input on each portion.
Yep.
And at other times it's like, okay, I wrote the lyrics. You go off with that and do what you want with it, or vice versa.
Right.
Here's the music.
Right.
You go, and it can be, so there's
wide range.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to interject and take me back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
What may ever motivated you to start writing to begin with?
I was a lonely kid with no life.
Made up these worlds and yeah.
Yeah. Running through the cornfields of Southern Indiana and made up all these worlds. And my mom, I was very annoying, and my mom would say, go out and just play pretend or whatever. I'm like, oh, okay, I can pretend. And so initially as a kid, you know, the worlds and characters. The
imagination was fostered.
Yeah. And, my toys would have personalities and they would interact, and my He-Man and my G.I. Joes would talk to each other, and they would no longer be He-Man and G.I. Joes. They would be completely different characters. Mm-hmm. Had Fisher Price Adventure people that were actually really cool and different. And so a lot of those early ideas that I had were very derivative. They would be based on other characters from other things, or I would become one of the characters from, like whip off my glasses and suddenly I'm Superman.
Right. Know? Right. And goodbye, Clark Kent.
And then I trip over everything. Yeah. I can't see. That's pretty much how I got started. And then I think in the back of my mind, I thought, oh, someday I'm going to write. Mm-hmm. Someday when I'm older, I'm going to write.
Yeah.
And then at some point in my mid to late 20s or so, I'm like, okay, when is someday?
Right, right.
So someday, because I kept thinking the someday is going to come, but it's not here yet.
Yeah.
And so at some point I had to get off my rear end and actually try to write something. And I took a couple creative writing classes in college, which helped me so much.
Really?
Like, oh, yeah. I still use them. And they were basically formatted like when I've done writing critique groups as an adult.
Yep.
They are formatted very much like my creative writing classes in college.
Okay.
So I still use those skills today that I learned in those, even though I didn't major in it, I didn't minor in it, but I took those two creative writing classes and
they meant a lot to you.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. What was your first major, what you would consider your first significant book that you published? What was your most recent book that you published? And then what's your favorite book?
So my first significant one, I did try my hand at a short film in about 2005, I think. And I call that my coming out of the closet as a writer. Because writers were quite shy, introverted, And like being wanting to write was kind of like my dirty secret. It was like my dirty little secret. And so in order to make that movie, I worked on it and I got it to the point where I had the script. And I'm like, well, now that I've got a script, I guess I should probably try to do something with it. So then I tried to recruit actors, and then it just snowballed. And so, and then I had to show it to people. Then I spent months in a basement editing the thing, and then I had to show people. So really it was like my coming out of the closet as a writer. My dirty secret was out. I had to tell everybody
that you're a writer.
Yeah. Or trying to be a writer, right, at least at that point. And then Secular City Limits in 2008 was like a dystopian near future, that I put out. And that was another big, so that was kind of like my first, like where I got a tiny bit of notoriety, not a lot.
So describe Secular City Limits.
Secular City Limits. It used to be fiction. It was meant to be fiction. It's a dystopian near future where, in the United States, the separation between church and state has collapsed. And so states and neighborhoods have separated along religious divisions. And the main character is a single mother who just wants to get her kid into a good school. And so they end up being, she takes two kids from her congregation and her son across state lines in search of a new secular city where she's told they can find good schools, jobs, and tolerance. But there's twists and turns and obstacles and surprises.
Okay.
Oh, I understand your comment now.
Then, yeah.
About it.
Yeah.
It was supposed to all be fiction.
It was supposed to be all be fiction. And people will come.
Quit writing that kind of stuff.
Right. I know.
You're manifesting.
It wasn't a recipe book, you guys.
A little too predictive. So, okay. That was your, I guess you would consider the first published thing that you really felt like is a major. Mm-hmm.
That's the first one that counts.
What's your most recent one?
My most recent one is also my favorite.
Oh, you're going to answer both in the same question.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Because it was such a long time coming.
But you're not supposed to have favorites, right? Of your children.
Yeah, but this one's going to be my favorite. And okay. Some people said, oh, well, it's your favorite now because it's most recent and your next one will then be the next. No, I think this one's going to stay my favorite.
For a while, at least.
Yeah, because I just love short stories so much.
Uh-huh.
And this is a short story collection. Again, 30 years, I think I already mentioned this probably, 30 years worth of stories. And I just love the short story format. I love the amount of it's not a huge time investment to read a short story. I think they're creative. There's a lot of variety in there. Whereas my paranormal mystery books, I really love Waking Terror. I thought it's a lot of fun. It's got some mystery. It's got some crazy paranormal stuff. It's got a mishmash of genres. So there's a lot of stuff I really love about that. And a lot of the things just seem to click in that. The way the plot, you know, just
comes and goes. And
the dominoes.
Yeah.
Like plot, to me, like it's like a book is like dominoes. And mm-hmm. So every chapter you hit one domino. And when you do it well, it's like each domino just tick, 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 tick. And it seems so like, it's like it takes a lot of work, but when you read it, it just seems like there was no other way it could have been because it just seems so natural.
Right.
Right. Of course it happened that way, but it didn't happen. Like it was only because I made it happen that way on the paper. And now it seems like so like, oh, there was no other way it could have possibly been written. But of course there's an infinite number of ways it could have been written. But so that Waking Terror, I'm really proud of that. I really love it. Just because of the variety and the short story format and the twists and the turns and that Twilight Zone-esque kind of the endings and twists and things. Just love the short story.
You know, I love as you're talking about the different types of writing and things that you've been involved in. You know, growing up, I read a little bit. You know, I did what I had to for school and I read a few things, but I didn't read a lot. But I read.
Yeah.
We were early in our marriage. I had seen a article or a news story about people who read, and it could be comic books, but people who tend to read tend to be more intelligent. And so I was like, well, I want to be one of those people. And it's that point that I started reading and really had become a prolific reader. You've expressed that you've had a lot of these stories that you've developed in your mind through imagination and all of that. Are you a reader?
Yes. But I, with a caveat, I will say that I am a slow reader.
Okay.
because like I read, and I didn't realize this until I talked to people, because I know a lot of people, they read a lot.
Yeah.
They read very quickly. And I read about the same speed as I'm talking right now.
Okay.
So it takes me a little longer. I also have bad eyesight. I love audio, which is one of the reasons I love audiobooks.
Yeah.
Audiobooks are great. So I don't read as much quantity as maybe as I would like, but I relish the ones that I read.
That you do. Okay.
Yeah. And, in terms of intelligence, I was going to say, I think writing and reading, one of the things it does is it exposes you to thinking from multiple points of view, which is something like, so not necessarily IQ wise, I don't necessarily think a reader or writer necessarily is smarter than anybody else.
Right.
But just that habit of
expansion.
If I hear two people arguing, I don't immediately take a side.
Mm-hmm.
I try to, because usually when two people are arguing, they're both a little bit right.
Yep. And both a little wrong.
And both a little bit wrong. Right. So I tend to look at things from multiple points of view. And I didn't even, this is like a new realization I've had recently.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people I know, they cannot do that.
Yeah.
They just don't even seem capable of it. And then they assume when they're talking to me that I'm doing that as well. And I'm like, I'm trying to look at both points of view.
I'm Switzerland right here.
Right. Yeah. But if I'm looking at both, I'm obviously the opposite of whatever side they're on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's,
you know, when you say that, I read a book, I read books even for enjoyment, but I'll read some related to work and always learning, growing kind of thing. The book's called The Technology Fallacy. And the concept is that, well, technology is going to take over the world. But one of the things that it says in there is that the best technology in the world can be developed. But if you're not able to articulate what it does, how to use it, and the benefit for somebody else, it's useless.
Yeah.
And that has stuck with me, that you do have to be able to articulate things, or, you know, that great invention, that great idea, it doesn't come out.
Yeah. And then when it does come out, we might think it's going to do a certain thing. And then once humans get hold of it,
it's like, no,
like the people that came up with the internet, they probably didn't think we were going to be, you know, selling our self-published books on there, you know,
right.
And arguing about different things.
Yeah. Who would have thought? Yeah.
I saw a video recently that was obviously something that was recorded maybe way back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it's a man with a son, and they're in this room with this giant computer. Back in those days, computers filled entire rooms. Mm-hmm. You didn't have one in your house. And he's talking to a man there who's talking about technology that's going to come. And he's telling this man and his son that one day you'll have a computer that will be in your home. It'll have a television screen. You'll be able to see people. You'll be able to do all your business remotely. And it's like, at the time, that would have been completely beyond.
Sure, you will. Yeah.
Well, and I'll just interject. I know you're getting ready to say something else, but all of the growing up, Star Trek, loved Star Trek. And it's like, all the things that are on there, we have them now. You know, it's like I can just talk to my computer and it can transcribe and do the stuff. So.
Even replicators now.
You need 3D
mm-hmm. printers. Yeah. You just program it in and it spits it out. Well, slowly, but it spits it out.
Yeah.
All right. So I wanted to talk a minute, because I have read one of Matthew's books. I've read The Waking Terror.
Thank you.
So Matthew and I did a joint book event together at a place on the east side of Indianapolis called Porter Books and Bread.
Oh, that's a great
Bread
place.
And Books. I always get that backwards. Mm-hmm. And we shared a table. So we traded books, and I got his Waking Terror book, which was a fun little read. It's I guess you would consider it a novella. Or is this
I think that's a novella length. Yeah. It's 100 and something pages.
Yeah. And I just want to read the back of it just to kind of give you a feel for some of the material that's in The Waking Terror.
Okay. Tell us.
It says a nightmare haunts the Albuquerque suburbs, which side note, but I got in a lot of trouble trying to say Albuquerque one time. So I have to really think about it when I read it. It says, private investigator Jack Mailer thought he finally had an easy assignment, a routine life insurance claim investigation. He was looking forward to having the afternoon off to go hiking with his dogs, but the widowed husband acts like he has something to hide. Jack witnesses a surreal apparition, feeding on the dead wife's ghost. When the voiceless entity follows Jack home and a rogue policeman threatens to frame him for murder, this easy case gets personal. To solve this mystery, Jack must seek answers in his own shameful past, risking life and sanity to discover the secret of the waking terror before his dream of a normal life turns to smoke. Why can't anything be simple?
Ooh.
So that's the waking terror.
Thank you. That was a really well-written back copy, by the way.
Yes, it was.
So I wonder who the writer was who created that. Let's shift a little bit. So I know you because you're active in the local author community.
Which is a great community.
I'm like a rash. I just keep popping up. You can't get rid of me.
Yeah, we've done a number of of events together. I know that Matthew and I, besides the Porter Books and Bread and the Christmas Gift and Hobby Show, we also did the Columbus Comic Con together. We were talking downstairs about one that we had at the holidays in downtown Indianapolis, probably way back in 2018. But you're active in the local author community. What do you enjoy and what do you gain through that association? That's a little bit shift in the conversation.
That's a great question. I think, because initially I think with a lot of us, there's a bit of a, there's the risk, I think, in any arts type community of becoming overly competitive or overly jealous of each other. You see, because, you know, obviously I've seen a lot of people that, you know, you'll be in an event and they'll sell more books than you, or they've got more books than you, or they're getting more attention than you for their book. You know? So there's that. But I've been very fortunate. I met some artists actually that really inspired me in the early 2000s and seeing how they interacted with each other, because they were all doing different kinds of art. And I see this in the local music scene as well. People are doing different kinds of music, different skill levels, different avenues. Some people are more hobbyist. Some people are more professional, doing it for money. Some people have been able to quit their day job actually and fully commit to this, and most of us cannot do that. Right. I tell you right now, I am not, you know, I still need to pay my bills with another job. So I think, so just seeing that supportiveness of each other and being that enthusiasm too, like when you meet somebody and you're not, you know, you I think, you know, maybe you can't completely ever get rid of some of that. That's always going to be there. But just that enthusiasm when you meet somebody that's interested in the same stuff or the same same types of things. And when you can actually, when people ask me a question and I actually know the answer, like, how do I do this? You know, I want to write a book and I don't know how to do this aspect. And I'm like, I know, I can answer that question. Yeah. And so that makes me feel, you know, useful.
You're being useful.
I'm useful. Exactly. I'm not, you know. So that's always a good feeling to, you know, and then things also then, on the flip side of that, maybe I want to do a thing and I don't know how to do it. And I meet somebody and I say, oh, wow, you've done this thing before. Right. I would, but I don't know how to do that thing. Yeah. And then we can share knowledge and they can tell me not only what they did that worked, but what they tried that didn't work. And then I can not do that.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Save me some steps and vice versa. I can do that. For others too. So sometimes, yeah, it's been really great. It's almost like a mutual admiration society when we get together.
And, support.
Yeah. We right. support each other and talk about each other's work. And
there is a certain natural competitiveness. You know, it's like, I don't resent some of my fellow authors when, you know, we're at an event together and they're selling a lot and maybe, you know, I'm going doing through a little slow period or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they got 15 people over around their table and I got nobody, you know, but because it flows, right? And I have my turn and they have their turn. And so I don't really resent it, but sometimes you do have this natural competitiveness. Like, I really want to be there too. But I really think that at least in the Indianapolis area, the ones that we're associated with, Matthew, I think we are very supportive of one another.
Oh, yeah.
Even if we may feel a little competitiveness, we're still very supportive of one another within the community. And that's been very heartwarming for me. Something that I've really enjoyed getting to know guys like you and Ben O'Neill and George Kramer and Chris Clouser and some Savannah of the others, Goins Savannah Goins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Savannah Goins. So it's been a very special time to be able to do that.
I think that mm-hmm. would be encouraging too. If there's somebody out there who's been thinking, I'm going to write. Mm-hmm. And then they start and then they stumble across another local author
yeah.
to know that it is a supportive community. You know, I think that could encourage people out there.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think, one of the last, the Harvest Fest, there was a young guy that came up to me and was talking about writing, and it just, you know, it's fun. Plus a lot of times, I hate to say it, but at these events, sometimes we're bored.
Yeah.
So you come up and you come up and talk to us about a writing project. And I'm like, somebody's talking to me, you know, I'm just so excited and happy to talk to you. And then you're talking to me about something I'm interested in, which is writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which is, for me, that's just fun to talk about.
Sure. Every once in a while, somebody says, hey, can we take a picture?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like,
really?
Yeah. I've had
a
couple of times this year. And it's like, part of me is like, really? You want a picture with me? But then there's a part of me, it's like, oh, this is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody wants to take a picture with me yeah. as the author. So it's kind of fun.
It's not only do they have the book, but they have immortalized the moment that they met the author.
Well, and that, I think that means something to people when you meet the author or you have the book and it's signed or if mm-hmm. it's signed specifically to, you know, here to Nancy from Matthew yeah. or what, you know,
it's easy to forget because we're authors and we know each yeah. other and we see each other everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's easy to be like, we're not special.
Yeah. We've done this.
But especially when I get out to some of the smaller towns mm-hmm. around, because in Indianapolis, if you throw a ball in the air, there's a very good chance it's going to hit an author or an aspiring author in the head.
Yeah.
So if you get out in the surrounding areas.
Sure.
And, I was in the first time I was at Newcastle tabling
uh-huh.
and they have a Ren Fair out there, which Savannah and Laura, Savannah that you mentioned, and also our friend Laura has done that event as well. We'll be out there and like, they're just selling, here's selling books. And then they're like, wait a minute, you wrote these?
Yeah.
Like this realization is like, and you're like, oh yeah. It is special.
It
you're
is. Like,
yeah, you're not.
Everybody a has a you're book
not
a books, in them.
You're not a bookstore guy. You're actually the person who wrote the book.
Yeah. Because the truth is, everybody has a story. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a book in them, but yes. very few. And that was the one thing I told Mike that I'm so proud of him and his efforts. The percentage of people who actually sit down and mm-hmm. do it,
yes,
is much smaller.
Oh yes, definitely.
What advice do you give an aspiring author? I mean, like mm-hmm. like myself. You have some people come up and say, you know, I always thought I should write a book.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to them?
Oh, gosh. I guess if somebody said, I would say, well, what stopped you? Probably it would be, you know, and or actually, so I like a lot of times I'll just say, well, what kind of a book would you write? What kind of a book did you want to write? And start talking to them about, you know, what their idea was and things like that. And, you know, maybe that'll get some of the juices rolling yeah. and be like, oh yeah, that's the book I wanted to write. And
yeah.
And, but yeah. And then we can get more specific then depending on like what specific questions they have. And I'm pretty accessible too. Like if people have questions, they can, you know, message me or stuff and I'll answer.
Speaking of that, mm-hmm. how do people find your books? Obviously yes. you're out and about the town, but how do they find you? How do they find your books?
We could have listeners. We were talking this morning that, you know, we had a whole bunch of downloads of our podcast in Indonesia this week.
Ooh.
So I was looking at it. And we've got listeners all over the world.
Nice.
Most of them are in the United States and most of those are in Indianapolis, but mm-hmm. still we got a lot of listeners in different places. So how do people find Matthew Barron and his works?
That is a great segue. My website is submatterpress.com. That's my publishing imprint, submatterpress.com. And then if you go to matthewbarron.com, that will take you to my Amazon author page as well, where all my books are listed on Amazon.
So they could go on Amazon and even type in your name to yep. do a search?
Yes, okay. They can go and go to Amazon and type in a search.
And that should bring spell up your last name.
Barron.
Okay. Because yes. that could be spelled a couple of different ways.
It can indeed. And it's Matthew, Matthew.
Okay.
If you type in Matt, I think some something else.
Somebody else comes along.
So, yeah.
And you gotta be careful when the something else comes.
Right. Right.
Sometimes.
So yeah, those are the easiest ways to find me. I do have an Amazon author page, things like that for more, and I have a mailing list, but that, you know, for more like, but yeah, generally just to find my books and stuff. And on my website, submatterpress.com, I'll do my, event calendar.
Oh, that's nice.
And which I have some events. I'm still in the planning stages, but I know I'm going to be it sounds like I'm going to be doing some panels and presentations at Indiana Comic Con this year, probably.
Fun.
And some other events that I've got planned.
Mentioned that because I'm going to have a table there.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to have a table this time around, unfortunately, but I'll be.
I've never had a table at a Comic Con.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit nervous because I'm supposed to be there for the full 3 days.
That's a long, yeah.
And I don't think you're supposed to leave your table unmanned. And I'm like, how am I going to go to the restroom?
Yeah.
I haven't quite figured that all out. So
yeah, fortunately, like a lot of the things that I'm sure you've done, your neighbors will help you out. So you don't have to like sneak a cup under the table or anything like that. They'll help you out when you need a bathroom break.
A little real long tube.
Yeah, real long tube.
So, you know, the thing I tell aspiring authors, I think, is, hey, you know, the first step is just to write it.
Yeah.
You know, you think you got something, just sit down and start writing. Just start writing. Mm-hmm. You can fix all the mistakes. You can fix all the errors. After the fact, but if you don't ever actually write it, you're never going to have it done. So just start writing. And then we'll help work out the details later.
Yeah. You can't proofread it until there's something on the paper.
Yeah.
Right.
Can't. And, now with me personally, this doesn't work for everybody, but for me personally, I started out with short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me a lot.
Mike did that.
Oh, you did that? Yeah.
Well,
not publishing, but he just started playing around with
writing. Yeah, I started writing some short stories. Actually, several of the early ones. Well, I shouldn't say several. There's a few of the early ones and some others I did later that ended up in my collection of short stories. That's the Cutter's Notch Interludes. But I had one short story early on, which when I go back and read it now, it's terrible. I like the concept, but it would have to be completely rewritten. And then I tried to write a novel early on,
mm-hmm.
and I got about 3/4 of the way through the story and just stopped.
Mm.
And now it's 25 years in the past. So it's like, there's no way I'm going to ever finish
but
that.
For you, the short stories was a way to ease into.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit, because I could hone my craft in smaller bursts.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of trying to write 10,000 pages or whatever, you know, 1,000 pages of an epic. And then be like, oh wait, this is crap. Cause I don't know what I'm doing. I could write, you know, 10 pages and find out, oh wow, this is crap. Cause I don't know what I'm doing.
With the short stories. I mean, it sounds like when you've done the graphic novels and the playwrights and you know that kind of thing, you've plotted everything out.
Mm-hmm.
With the short stories being smaller, do you plot those as well or do you just write?
Generally I have, there's this concept, pantser versus plotter.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is like two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
So the pantser is somebody that just sits down with a blank sheet of paper and starts writing.
Yep.
And then after 1,000 pages, they might have 100-page book. And then on the opposite extreme is then the plotter who has a very precise outline that they
where
know
where the characters are going, exactly. The story's going. Yeah.
They sit down, they're okay. I'm writing this scene today because it's very, the downside of that is then sometimes the characters just go where the outline says, and they might not behave as naturally as they might if you were more free flowing.
Right.
So I kind of try to do a hybrid and, the short stories, especially I usually have some concept I want to explore or an ending that I'm thinking about. There's some aspect that's already in my brain before I start. But with the short story, it doesn't necessarily have to be super detailed.
Right.
And then with anything I've written, I try to stay loose. So like I have this concept I want to explore, or I think, ooh, I'm going to come. This is this twist I want to do.
Yeah.
And then when I actually get done writing, that may not be in there.
Sure, sure.
It may be completely different.
One of the things that has interested me as Mike has gotten involved and we've met other authors and such was I forget who we were talking to, and they were like, yeah, then and the character went someplace I didn't know. I'm like, wait a minute, you're the writer.
How does that happen?
You determine where that character is going. They're like, well, sometimes that story mm-hmm. or that character can can impact.
I was just writing a scene recently, actually. This is something I'm kind of superstitious about, talking about projects too early. So sure. I'm not going to give any details.
Yeah.
But I was writing a scene where I want it to be more of an action, fast paced action book. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, the main character is finally going to meet the bad guy. And then they're going to have an argument, blah, blah, blah. And then, but then the main character, to my surprise, said, actually, that's not a bad idea. Maybe we should do that. And I'm like, oh crap. Now there's no fight. But then, so I'm missing. Now we don't have that action beat there right. that I expected,
right.
but it's actually a more satisfying story because there's that temptation for the main character to be like, yeah, I could see that point of view. Maybe we could do that thing. Maybe that's not such a bad idea.
Very interesting.
And that's, you know, and so I always say that's part of the thing with when your outline says character goes left, but then you get to that point of the story, you could force them to go left because that's what the outline says. But then sometimes you're like, why would the character go left there, though?
Yeah.
There's no reason that
doesn't make
there's
sense
some
anymore.
So there's right. some flexibility to the process.
So then they go right. And then you're like, well, crap, now I don't know what happens next.
So here on the podcast,
mm-hmm.
and like we said, you've written a lot of books. We've told people how to go and look at them.
Yay.
What would you want to, you know, here's your 2-minute pitch or whatever. What would you want people to know about you or your mm-hmm. books?
Oh, wow. Let's see. I think I would just say give them a chance. And I write such a diverse, wide array of books. I don't necessarily expect any one person to like every single thing I've ever written.
Thank you.
So you're welcome.
Is there one that you would recommend yeah. that they start with?
Oh, well, of course, I'm going to say Dissonant Dreams, which is the short story collection.
Yeah, yeah.
And because it's my favorite one, and also because they're short. And And to even more exemplify what I just said, in the intro of that book, I say, if you don't like the story you're reading, skip to the next one.
Okay.
Because the stories are so different that I'm hoping that everybody can find something to like in that
sure.
book. But maybe not everybody's going to like everything in that book.
I said, thank you. And I appreciate it because I know of the books Mike has written. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of him. Mm-hmm. I think he writes well. I haven't liked all the stories
mm-hmm.
and so, but I want to be supportive
yeah.
because I am. So, at any rate,
yeah,
thank you for
just
saying
to
that.
Clarify. She does like some of the stories.
Yes, I do. I do. And I do like short stories.
Yeah.
I think those are, like you said, a fun, quick, easy read to move through.
That's really awesome that you both can be honest about that too.
Right. And we're still married.
Yeah, and you're still married. I had an ex cause I want to know, like I had an ex-girlfriend who I could tell she did not like one of my books but she would never say it out loud. I could just tell though.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
yeah,
just say it. It's fine. Like I don't, you know, and I really, her opinion, like I really valued her opinion. So I kind of wanted to hear her thoughts on
it. Yeah.
And not like, and I think another thing people don't always know as a writer, we have to take feedback.
Yes.
And so
you have to be prepared for that if you're going to write.
Right. And yeah. So
you don't want someone to be cruel, but you do
exactly.
want to have you do want fair feedback.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's not like, you know, you might feel like, oh no, you're insulting our babies. And yeah, in a way you kind of are, but.
yeah.
But we're kind of used to it. And we had to, if we're good writers, it meant at some point we learned. And in order to learn, that meant we had to learn how to take feedback at some point.
Yeah.
All right. It's time for the random question.
This has been so fun, Matthew. So I'm shaking the random question box.
Dum, dum, dum.
You get to pick out the question.
Ooh, I'm scared.
You should be.
Okay. I'm reaching my hand
into
the thing.
It's going to be something really dull. Tell
All
us
right.
your favorite color. No.
Okay.
What's your favorite color?
All right. So I have reached into the bin of questions. Okay. The question is, what was your favorite thing on the playground when you were a kid?
Huh.
Oh.
So that's an easy answer.
Yeah.
The monkey bars.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Were you good at them?
We had the old school metal things that they won't put on there anymore.
And if the sun shines on it, your hands burn. Yeah.
Well, it also had concrete at the bottom. Yeah. And so a couple people got hurt. And so now they don't put those in.
It was a real adventure back then.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. We had this one monkey bars. It was like a, it looked like a cage or something.
But yeah.
You could do lots of things. It was when we played tag, that was base.
Okay.
You could climb to the top. You could climb into the middle. It could, you know, so many things. And then you had the other thing with, I don't know if it's also called monkey bars, where you do the brachiation.
Yeah. Like swing. When you had to do in gym class in high school or something where you'd have to
reach one arm
right,
out
right
and then
arm,
swing on that arm like
yeah.
a monkey.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's still called monkey bars or.
I don't know either.
Yeah, I don't know what that one was called.
But that one was also fun. And that was also where the older girls hung out when I was in grade
school.
Well,
there's the motivation so, to, yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Explains a lot about my personality.
Mike, how about you?
Well, my first thought was my favorite thing on the playground was, you know, had to be, you know, either a girl named Cheryl or a girl named Holly or, you know, one of the girls. But I wasn't much of a ladies man back then when I was 8 and 9. But
I was more of one when I was 7.
But I,
you had more riz going.
Well, I was still cute back then.
When I was in first grade, Holly had a thing for me, I must say. So,
oh, yeah, Holly.
It was either me or Jimmy. She liked me or Jimmy at any given time. Hello, Holly. I hope you listen. But at any rate, probably, you know, my school playground, I don't remember them having one. But at the park, they did. And it was one of those merry-go-round things,
yeah,
you know, where
yeah.
you sat on it and somebody spun mm-hmm. it and you could get it going really, really, really super fast.
Oh yeah.
Death-defying merry-go-round.
Yeah, I loved that little thing.
I was my favorite too. I would say that was my favorite although I think I liked riding it more than being the person, because sometimes you would stand there and just mm-hmm. make it go around, but other times you would run alongside it, mm-hmm. and I didn't like that because it would end up going too fast and I couldn't keep up, and then your feet are dragging.
I would run alongside it and then jump on.
That's what I would do,
that
too.
That was the cool thing.
And then I would be hanging on the metal. And your feet would be swinging out because of the centripetal force.
Yeah.
You're like,
Were the days.
Yeah. That was crazy. You know, when I was a kid, I don't know about you, Matthew, because you're younger than me, but when I was a kid, you had these giant swings, but you had these giant swings where the swing was like 20 feet up.
Oh yeah.
And so when you got to the apex that it was hooked of to, your swing, you're way off the ground.
Oh yeah.
And I would see some kids that looked like they were almost going to swing it
all the way
over.
Loop.
Yep.
There was a cartoon, I remember, where the girls were growing up, the Inside Out Boy or whatever, mm-hmm. that he actually did that on the swing, and supposedly it turned him inside out. So you saw his bones in the cartoon. You could see the boy, bones.
I feel like I almost came close before when I was a kid, because the chain didn't have any slack as you were swinging at like a pendulum. But then when you got to a certain point,
it was like a slack drop.
Yeah, you could feel, the chain would slacken, and then you would... Yeah. And so I got to that point. So,
you start getting a little bit scared.
Yeah, then I would start getting scared and back off a little bit.
And then Heakin Park in Muncie had the giant swings that were 20 feet up. But they also had two bars that came down. On one side was a little. Well, on one side was like a little ladder. And the other side was just a pole that you could slide down. But I'm thinking, this is set up for some kid to climb 20 feet in the mm-hmm. air with no support.
Yeah.
Crawl over the bar on the top and slide down the other side. And how did kids not die? And, you know, maybe they did. That's kind of the point. Maybe they did. But that I always looked at that and I thought, no, mm-hmm. not doing that one.
Ours weren't designed to do that, but we did it anyway.
Yeah.
So we never went all the way across, but I definitely on the V.
Yeah.
I would get, because there was usually like a bar in the middle that you could climb up
support,
on.
Yeah.
And then at that point, the top of the A was close enough that you could kind of monkey up there and get to the top.
Yeah.
And then it was a jungle gym again.
There you go.
I kind of miss playgrounds.
Now I want to go to the park.
I know.
We need to go to a
playground. Let's go to Perry Park is right down here.
We should do it at adult play day.
Those old fools out there on the...
Yeah.
Of course, everything's cushioned now, so we'd be safe. We'd probably only break a hip. So.
I think you still have to sign a waiver. I think probably. Especially when they saw us over there.
Yeah, they were like, okay. Well, they would just call the police. People hanging around with the little kids.
Yeah.
So at any rate, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the podcast.
Listeners, please go to his website and check out his variety of work.
Yeah. Submatterpress.com.
And thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot of fun doing this.
We do. If you don't have fun, it's not worth doing.
Yeah.
And thank you, Bill Whitehair, for being our post-production guy. Much appreciated all your work that you do. And folks, we will catch you again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Your hosts have been Michael and Nancy DeCamp. Michael is the author of several fantasy thriller novels and short stories that can be found on Amazon or ordered through your local bookseller. Visit www.authormichaeldecamp.com to learn more. His most recent release, The Purveyor of Death, Doc Moon Book 1, is a classic young adult horror novel and the first book in a new series. It's guaranteed to keep you turning pages. Nancy is Michael's number one fan with a love and appreciation for creativity everywhere. The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. Subscribe to catch each new episode as it drops. You can reach us by sending an email to michael@authormichaeldecamp.com. Join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.